Good afternoon, everybody. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee meeting to order at 1:31 p.m. on Tuesday, March 15th. The Ides of March. We're meeting in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Begich, Senator Hughes, Senator Costello, and Senator Reinbold, and myself, Senator Wilson. We have a quorum to conduct business. This afternoon, we have one item of business. Please note for some folks that Senate Bill 211, Missing and Murder Indigenous Women, have been pulled from the agenda today due to the sponsor's request just to work out some technical issues and language with the House Companion version. We'll continue today to discuss and take questions on SB 124, Mental Health Facilities and Meds. This committee took up this legislation again for this session on April 8th. And apparently, Senator Hughes' phone is sorry for something.
On Friday from Copa,
please. I think we have donuts. Yes. Anyway, this committee will, committee members will work through questions. Available to the committee is Heather Carpenter, our healthcare policy advisor from DHSS, is in the room. Ms. Nancy Meade from the Alaska Court System, Kelly Howe, special commissioner from Commissioner of Department of Public Safety, Stephen Williams is on Teams. He's the CEO of Alaska Mental Trust Authority, and I believe in lieu of Jennifer Giroux Johnson, the director of behavioral health, we have the assistant deputy director of behavioral health, Ms. Brina Brown, on Teams available for questions, and Steve Bookman, the senior assistant attorney general from the Department of Law, is also on Teams. So at this time, is any questions from the committee to finish our discussion on SB 124?
Maybe just one.
All right, we'll go to.
Oh, sorry.
She was reaching for the mic first, and we'll go from Senator Reinbold, ask a question or two, and then we'll go to Senator Begich.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what is better to do. I have several amendments. I think you are aware of that. But I have so many questions that, I mean, I don't even know if you want me to ask like five right now and maybe five later or five.
Let's just ask a couple first.
Okay.
And then we'll go from there first, and then we'll work through them.
Okay.
Cindy Reinbold.
Okay. So first of all, on page one, line 9, it says the arresting officer believes in good faith that the purpose is suffering from an acute behavioral health crisis. It just sounds so vague to me. And so I really need clarification. To me, that needs sidebars and standards and, you know, that's where I want to start.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Carpenter, for coming up. And I think I'll start with this answer because I think that this was take a brief at ease. All right, so I think I'll take a stab at answering this from our last committee meeting on the 8th. I believe Commissioner Cockrell talked upon that the troopers and different law enforcement agencies have a sort of mental health, behavioral health training that they provide to their law enforcement officers. And so that's the arresting officer believes in good faith, meaning that the training that they have is applicable to the situation that they are currently dealing with. And I'll ask Ms. Carpenter if she could further elaborate or if have any other clarification on that.
Chair Wilson, for the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS. That is correct. That is what Commissioner Cockrell spoke to. And I apologize. Public Safety had freestanding meetings, so they were unable to come today, but we can also have them follow up.
Yeah. Senator Reinbold.
Yeah, so I just, that to me is a major red flag in this bill. I think there needs to be very clear identifiers that are measurable. I think that's how healthcare usually you have to measure objectives. So I think that's one really important issue. I want to go into section number 4. Section number 4, this one concerns me, the mental health professional. I want to, someone to really describe who exactly that mental health professional is. That would be on page 2, section 4.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I will just remind you that these first 10 sections are conforming edits, so we did not change the underlying statutes that were passed in 2020. That being said, when you're looking at a mental health professional, that would be a mental health professional at an evaluation facility as it is defined in 4730.915. And last week I provided the committee with the definition, you know, cheat sheet, so you could see that exact definition. And if you would like me to read that into the record, I can do so.
Yes, please.
Yes. Please, Ms. Carpenter.
Okay, let me find. Can I have an at ease just to find that document?
Yes, at ease. Record, just waiting for a distribution of some what Ms. Carpenter is going to read off to us, but we'll ask for a reminder of the question from Senator Reinbold.
I believe that question was on page 2, line 12. It was to define the mental health professional.
Ms. Carpenter.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, the mental health professional definition that is cross-referenced here would be found in section 4730.915.13. This is the definition section for the involuntary commitment statutes, and I will go ahead and read it into the record. A mental health professional means a psychiatrist or physician who is licensed by the state medical board to practice in the state or is employed by the federal government, a clinical psychologist licensed by the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, a psychological associate trained in clinical psychology and licensed by the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, an advanced practice registered nurse or a registered nurse with a master's degree in psychiatric nursing, licensed by the State Board of Nursing, a marital and family therapist licensed by the Board of Marital and Family Therapy, a professional counselor licensed by the Board of Professional Counselors, a clinical social worker licensed by the Board of Social Work Examiners, and a person who, A, has a master's degree in the field of mental health, B, has at least 12 months of post-master's working experience in the field of mental illness, and C, is working under the supervision of a type of license listed in this paragraph.
All right, Senator Reinbold.
So, I'm trying to find, there's a few places in the bill where you have deleted brackets. And so, for example, on page 3, you are deleting a psychiatrist or physician who is licensed to practice in the state or employed by the federal government or a clinical psychologist licensed by the state or Board of Psychology and Psychological Associate Examiners with probable cause. There's brackets around where you're deleting. So tell me where you're deleting, because it just seems like we're watering down who's allowed to do this, and that's where my concern is.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, that's a great question. We're actually not watering it down. All of those individuals that are eliminated, I actually just read in the definition of mental health professionals. So we're making it more streamlined by just saying a peace officer, a health officer. And as a reminder that I shared last week, the health officer is a new term, a mental health professional or a physician's assistant. So it's to be more streamlined and cross-referenced back to that mental health professional definition.
Senator Reinbold?
So tell me yes or no, you are deleting a licensed psychiatrist or physician who is licensed to practice in the state or federal government or a clinical psychologist. So you're just making it more of a broad definition, a health officer or mental health professional. To me, that's watering it down. To you, that doesn't seem to be watering it down.
So through the chair, Senator Reinbold, it is not deleting them because those types are found in the definition of a mental health professional. And it's the same definition that I just read in 4730.915. So instead of listing all of the provider types there, we are just listing the overall arching type of mental health professional because those are found in that definition.
Through the chair?
Yes.
Yeah,
because we're going to go to Senator.
Okay, it just I don't understand why in the world that you would be deleting it. And I think there's three different sections in the bill that you're deleting it. It just doesn't make sense to me still to this day. I think that I don't want just some random health officer, when you look at the definition, and it's way back further on page 11, you know, a state, municipal, or other local health officer, a public health nurse, an emergency medical physician, a paramedic, a firefighter, et cetera, making these huge decisions. And I want to make sure I'm not misreading the bill, but I want to make sure that there's someone who has trained, that has a degree, that has clear, you know, definitions and clear guidelines. I don't want just random people pulling people off the street. And I just feel like this bill has the potential to be a tremendous disaster if it's not very, very clearly outlined. So I've said I've had concerns from this bill from day one. I know it's the governor's bill, but there's a lot of red flags in that. That's why it just doesn't make sense to me that you're deleting, you know, the licensed psychologist and psychiatrist out of the bill.
So maybe it might be beneficial to talk upon just that piece where, I mean, the process that it's not those individuals that are doing sort of involuntary commitment, but there is a process of how we get there and the steps. And I think that was in the presentation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I understand Senator Reinbold's concern. She wants to make sure physicians, psychiatrists, these highly trained people are involved. And the definition, I'm going to look at the definition of mental health professional. I see the word psychiatrist. I see the word physician. I see the word clinical psychologist. So the very people that look like they're being deleted, Senator Reinbold, they're actually not being, because they're part of the professionals.
We're not going to get in this cross-fighting, I want to ask them why we're deleting it. I'm not asking you, I'm asking her why we're deleting them.
Okay, so I think that would be helpful to go through that sort of how it's not these – we're not deleting the professionals, but the terms are being deleted in terms of just for a cleaner – piece of legislation, they're being redefined in that section that Ms. Carpenter just read. Senator Costello.
Thank you. And, you know, I understand the desire to actually have something actually laid out in the statute versus having to go to the definition section. And I'm just curious, and maybe there's no answer to this, but when we have definitions in our statutes, how often when we read a law or when a law is read, does the layperson go to the section for definitions? And if there's a sense, I mean, the only reason I'm hearing to actually have this list be in the definitions is to make a few lines of statute go away and save that. When we have volumes upon volumes of statute books, and if there's a comfort level in having things listed out, because there might be the risk, it's so important to know who can do this that it might be worth actually, instead of streamlining it, but just stating everybody who can be a part of this. And I could see both sides of this, because if somebody's just flipping to the statute, to the law related to this, they may not know, oh, I have to go to the definition section to actually see what that means. And you know, we deal with this all the time, right? I mean, this is one of the things that happens in lawmaking, is that we have to decide, well, in the, you know, when you value being efficient or you value being very clear. And I think, you know, there's a case that can be made to have it be absolutely clear and have it be right there where the law is talking about this issue versus a definition section. So I just want to throw that out there, and I haven't really made up my mind which way to go, but I just think that if we are always trying to be efficient, then we should have started that effort at statehood to try to be as most efficient as possible. But really, I think the value of lawmaking is to make things very clear what the intent of the legislation was. And so I could see why it might be okay to add others, perhaps then to section off the individuals into a definition section.
Senator Costello, through the chair, I appreciate that thought process. And I will say, you know, one reason why we tried to clean this up here is because the term mental health professional is used throughout these statutes. So we wanted to be consistent so it is the same use, you know, when a provider or a peace officer or whoever is, you know, looking at the entire statute as well as the court system, that is that same consistent term used throughout. So, you know, I would be, this is kind of that one spot that we didn't call it a mental health professional instead of, you know, we listed them all out. Additionally, you know, the reason the new term health officer is there is because in this definition section, which I would say in this part of law is used very extensively because it is a very technical piece of law that is looked at by, you know, public safety, by providers, you know, physicians, as well as the court, is we actually used a definition of peace officer that didn't align with how peace officer was used in the rest of statutes. And that was, you know, a change we made in the CS was to split that definition so peace officer had the same meaning it had elsewhere in statute, and we created the new term health officer, you know, again, not deleting terms, but then adding in a paramedic, an EMT, and I believe a firefighter because of the work that is happening and how EMS responders happen throughout the state, and in particular how Anchorage is, you know, standing up mobile crisis teams.
Thank you. Senator Begich.
Thank you. I mean, my broader question was going to be about our discussion last week, but I'm just going to, for the point of clarity on the record, say a few things here. And the first is, these are just basically yes or no answers, so it should be fairly straightforward. So first question is on page 2, line 12, mental health professional is referenced. That is in existing statute, isn't it?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, yes.
And the per definition you gave us for mental health professional is already an existing statute, isn't it?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, yes.
So those exist now. On page 3, a psychiatrist or physician who is licensed to practice in the state or employed by the federal government, or a clinical psychologist licensed by the State Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, based on your prior two answers, is included still in Section 11, isn't it?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, yes.
Okay. So, effectively, you have answered and secured my understanding of this. We have additional folks that fall under health officer, and that clarifies what was meant by peace officer, health officer, the differing roles that we have encountered in the last few years as we've had health officers taking on some roles that were ascribed to peace officers. So we're trying to make sure that the definition is inclusive of those who are handling these particular cases. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, yes.
Okay. So my broader question, Mr. Chairman, if I may, my broader question is, when we were talking last week, we had a number of suggestions that were made and some really good responses from the department on that. I left that meeting without clarity of how we were supposed to resolve those things. Is it if you could tell me what you think the process should be for that, that would help me understand how we get to the amendment of those processes into this bill, because I'm satisfied with the answers you've given me based on the other questions.
Through the chair, Senator Begich, I've been working with the committee aide for Senator Wilson on, you know, items that we're going to be sending in particular in one document, so you know the department's response to Mr. Gottstein's amendments. We are fine with the language on all of them. We wanted to make minor edits to the medication suggestions he had, and actually I sent Mr. Gottstein an email last night with our suggested rewrite, and he was very satisfied with where we were going. You know, I wanted to be upfront and transparent with him, so I will be transmitting those hopefully by the end of the day today to Chair Wilson so he can decide how best to handle that.
Thank you. I just wanted to be sure, Mr. Chairman, that I had missed an opportunity to participate, and I haven't. That's the process I was hoping was going forward. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those are my questions for now.
All right. Thank you. And hopefully committee members did get the couple of emails that were sent out by the department on some of those questions that we also sent out to members. That was made on the March 15th letter from the commissioner, Crum. But Senator Hughes.
Thank you, and I'm sorry if you just covered it with Senator Beckett's series of questions, but Is there a statutory definition of health officer, or are we adding it in this bill? And if we are, where is it in the bill?
It's on page 11, starting on line 22. And we are adding it in this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Reinbold.
That's exactly what I wanted to cover, like I brought this up. So is this an accurate reading of the bill? I'm going to be skipping some words, but I want to know if this is accurate. So this is starting in section 11. So a health officer, so I'm going to define that, means a state or municipal or other local health officer, which seems kind of broad to me, a public health nurse, an emergency medical technician, a paramedic, a firefighter, or a person authorized by the court, if they have probable cause, which is a very low bar, believe that the person is suffering from mental illness, may cause the person to be taken into custody. That is kind of a big deal to me. Because all these people have the authority. Is that a correct?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, yes, but all of those individuals you read in the health officer definition, except for emergency medical technician, paramedic, or firefighter, have that authority today under the current definition of a peace officer found in 4730-915.
Senator Reinbold.
Follow up. Is it not true that you are creating new definitions, new facilities in this case, however, because I see lots of bold on here, new opportunities for them to take them new places?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, they are, if this bill were to pass, it will authorize the use of crisis stabilization centers and crisis residential centers as locations these individuals can take somebody into an, you know, ex parte hold for care. Currently, they can already do that. They can take them somewhere, but it ends up being, you know, API or one of our three designated evaluation and treatment center hospitals. And in the absence of that, they are waiting in emergency rooms or, in worst case scenario, jail until they can be taken to one of those facilities.
And I guess I don't have questions.
So can I follow up?
Yes, follow up.
So is there any new category of patients in any way or people in any way that can be taken to these new facilities, number one? And number two, is there anything different that you can do to these, they can do to these patients?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, it is no new category of patient or, you know, respondent that can be taken into custody. It has to, you know, be currently how it is now, whether it, when it meets that definition of gravely disabled. Which again is found in that definition section. Can you repeat the second part of your question?
Well, if you're straight up, you got to make sure you add the other part. Who? So this is probable cause. This is on page 3. The very last thing, it says has probable cause, which I believe is a very low bar, that the person is gravely disabled or suffering from a mental illness. So, you know, that to me is a pretty broad, you know, spectrum of mental illness. And what my concern is that there's a lot more people for a very broad area, and then there's a whole lot of things that they can do in these facilities. So this to me is a very, very serious bill. It's a very serious issue. And that's why I want to make sure that it's on the record exactly, you know, if there's any new people that can do anything, which you said no, there's new facilities, you said yes, and if there's anything new that can happen in these residential facilities, because we're going to get into some of the other concerns, but that's what I want to clarify on the record.
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, no, there are no new items or, you know, like care that can be provided that's not already allowed, you know, under the statute today.
And through the chair, there's no new diagnoses and no new people that can do this. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, correct, because again, as you were reading in section 11, it's that probable cause, you know, to believe that a person is gravely disabled or suffering from a mental illness and likely to cause serious harm to self or others. and, you know, I want to just keep reading because it adds good clarification, or others of such immediate nature that considerations of safety do not allow initiation of involuntary commitment proceedings set out in 4730-700. And that is what causes the person to be taken into custody.
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
So the clarification, in these residential facilities, there's nothing new. Is that what you were saying as well?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, there is nothing new that is not allowed under current law. You know, one thing we are adding through this bill is to authorize the providers who are allowed to under law today to give crisis medication at a crisis stabilization center or a crisis residential center if somebody meets that threshold, and only crisis medication.
So, and let me just clarify this and ask that question then. So this bill is really, it's allowing additional capacity to treat these folks in a less acute setting.
Chair Wilson, that is correct, and allows individuals to get into care quicker instead of waiting on our current, you know, wait list to get into care.
And that came about because of what was happening to our folks? They were staying where?
Chair Wilson, part of the you know, impetus for this bill was we were sued, as I explained, you know, last week by the Disability Law Center, because individuals were having to wait in locations like the Anchorage Correctional Facility in order to get into treatment at API or one of those three, you know, designated evaluation and treatment center facilities. So, you know, you could say their constitutional rights were being, you know, harmed because we could not get them into care in a timely manner. And one of the outcomes of that settlement and the ruling by Judge Morse was we would find locations to do the 72-hour evaluations at other less restrictive areas. And so we are standing that up through crisis residential centers.
Thank you. Senator Reinbold, and then we'll go to Senator Baggage.
So through the chair, because you mentioned it, I want to know how is the API doing right now? Because I certainly heard that there's some concerns there still. And then you said something new in this bill is that they can – whoever they is, but I'm hoping that that's actually a medical doctor can administer psychotropic drugs. So who can administer and what drugs can they administer? Those are very important questions.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, the individuals who can actually prescribe drugs, I'm looking for my notes so I don't mess it up, is a physician, bear with me for a second. I know it's an advanced nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. Those are the three by law that are allowed to prescribe crisis medication.
Second
part? Yes.
And I ask, okay, so you're saying those three are the only ones that can administer, and I ask specifically what type of drugs, and if you can list them, that would be really helpful, because a lot of times what happens is these patients actually have a problem with, and if you just watch the news, you'll go on and you'll have all these antidepressant drugs. Oh, you might have suicidal thoughts, you might do this, you might do that. So the drugs themselves, I used to sell these, you know, I used to work for a pharmaceutical company, and these agents can definitely create massive havoc. That's why I quit after 6 months. I couldn't do it anymore because I just fundamentally, the side effects were too much.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, you
before
actually...
Before you begin that, Ms. Carpenter, I'm sorry. I do want to do a clarification on that. There is a difference between prescribing and administering medications. So a nurse can administer a medication that is prescribed by one of those three, but it can only be prescribed by one of those three entities, a physician assistant, an advanced nurse practitioner, or an MD/DO, or, you know, a medical licensed provider, but they can be administered by another entity that is licensed to administer the medication that is then prescribed by one of those three individuals. I just wanted to clarify the difference between administer and prescription. So, sorry.
Thank you for the assist, Chair Wilson. Senator Reinbold, through the chair, you asked a similar question last April that we provided a written answer on May 3rd, and I'd be happy to recirculate that to the department where you asked for examples of crisis medications that can be given. It is impossible for us to list all specific ones, but we gave different categories I would say, though, when we're talking about crisis medications, it's short term. It's to address the immediate crisis, you know, situation, and we are not talking about long term prescribed medication that an individual may, you know, be taking. And in these centers, and currently how the law is today, that medication has to be, you know, consented to and agreed to if you're on a normal medication. You know, for instance, if I was a patient at API and had high blood pressure, they couldn't even give me my blood pressure medication if I did not consent, and that will stay the same.
Yeah. Through the chair, so there's no administering any psychotropic drugs without informed consent. It's the current law, I believe, that is now, and so that these cannot be administered without informed consent, correct?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, you know, I want to say correct, but I would like to, you know, say that, you know, crisis medications would be the only, you know, instance where there might not be informed consent because it went through that crisis definition and, you know, a crisis period.
Through the chair? That's correct. And this last question, then we're going to go to Senator Baggage.
Yeah, this is just a really big deal to me. I just am passionate about informed consent. And there has to be some sort of advocate, some sort of informed consent, because who is responsible if the person does go into a psychiatric episode because of the drug itself, which is actually pretty doggone common. So that's where my concern is with this informed consent, because I did read it in the bill. That was another major red flag for me. So I just believe informed consent must be mandated.
And I believe maybe we can talk upon the procedures of how that would work and how the notifications work. And I think that Ms. Mead may be able to talk upon a little bit on how the court system will do that. And we can get to her that question a little bit later as soon as Senator Baggage asks his question. Then we'll ask Ms. Mead to step up to talk a little bit about the court system's involvement of how this would work with their entities.
I have a couple of just clarifying questions. I want to be sure I understand. So under current law, this bill is not adding anyone new who can administer crisis medication, is it?
Through the chair, Senator Baggage. Going to say no, but then Chair Wilson gave me the difference between administer and prescribing. But how we have described it, no new individuals.
My understanding from your earlier answers to my questions is that would be correct because you had those definitions clearly defined. And I think that's the first question I have, which is just this isn't changing existing law when it comes to the administering of crisis medication. I want to go to something that something that the chairman described, in which I want to really get back to the heart of why we even have this bill before us. And that is because the Disability Law Center sued the state. They wanted to have alternatives available so that we weren't. I remember the article in the ADN about people being sent to the correctional system, et cetera. And what we were trying to do was work with litigants who were the recipients of care who felt as though the state had failed them, and the Disability Law Center was successful in its lawsuit, so we are settling, and they have on the record at our last meeting indicated that this bill meets those conditions. There were further conditions raised by patient groups that they felt could be added beyond what the Disability Law Center agreed to. So even going beyond the Disability Law Center's lawsuit, the department has, in our formal on-the-record conversations last week, agreed to add some of those patient considerations that were brought up in the Gottstein letter that was referred to earlier. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Baggage, correct.
So effectively what you're doing here is you're creating a broader array of services available to those who may be experiencing a psychotic episode or be suffering a mental illness. You're providing a broader and less invasive array of options here, which was the point of the Disability Law Center lawsuit, isn't it?
Through the chair, Senator Baggage, correct. And I would say, you know, I'd also clarify that to say more immediate care in cases, you know, I know the emergency room doctors provided a letter of support, and you know, they talk about individuals waiting in ER rooms, you know, where there's a lot of noise. They have to completely strip ER rooms of wires and, you know, make sure they can't, a patient can't injure themselves. And they're just having, you know, a medical professional, whether it's a CNA or a tech, sit there on a one-to-one observation until an individual can be taken to care. And they're not getting the, you know, crisis psychiatric care they need while they're sitting in an ER. The same thing that Commissioner Cockrell spoke to on the record last week about what happens when an individual is in the back of a trooper car while they're waiting to get into an appropriate facility. So it's really adding those new tools to the toolbox that we need in the involuntary commitment statutes.
And then a follow-up. Thank you for that answer. And in your opinion, I'm not asking for a definitive statement, but in your opinion, would the Disability Law Center have settled with you if what you were doing was placing those suffering psychotic episodes or mental health illnesses in a more vulnerable position?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, in my opinion, and I took part in the settlement negotiations with the Disability Law Center as well as the Public Defender Agency because they were the other party to the case, they would not have settled that, and Judge Morse would not have signed off on the settlement if we were, you know, adding or going the opposite way. You know, we truly are moving in less restrictive. And as a reminder, Judge Morse ordered that we could not just add more beds to API as the only solution to this case.
And Senator Begich, we do have Renee McFarland from our Public Defender Agency. She is online. And
Renee, well, may I ask the question of her?
Yes, and I think that might be appropriate to get that additional answer.
So, Madam Defender, if I may just sort of repeat the question, as a defender, do you find that this bill is somehow not responsive to the patient, or does it in fact appear to meet the issues brought up in defense of patients and in defense of patient, if I may say, patients' rights? To the best of your ability, what would be your answer to that?
For the record, this is Renee McFarland with the Public Defender Agency. And through the chair, Senator Begich, our portion of the lawsuit, I'm not the person that's most familiar with our role in the settlement negotiations, but what I can say is that, you know, if the facilities and the procedures that are implicated by this bill are funded, that could remedy some of the issues that we're seeing now. I think one of the concerns we have are changes to laws that don't actually end up in practice how they were intended, which is somewhat happened with the prior revision of these bills. And but assuming that all goes through, the general idea, I think, probably will benefit our clients. We do have concerns that we've noted to the people that have reached out with some aspects of the bill. There's some issues that we think raise constitutional concerns, but the overall idea of the bill, to the extent that it does stop our clients from being held in jail facilities and hospitals while waiting admission for treatment, I think that is something that we support.
If I may follow up.
Yes, Senator Begich.
And so if you were able to participate or review the last meeting of this committee when we talked about some of the very significant patient issues brought up by Attorney Jim Gottstein and the folks that he works with, do you feel that the movement by the department to address those, and I've received positive communication from Mr. Gottstein since then, that he felt that that was a movement in the right direction? Do you feel that to some degree addresses some of the concerns you retain, A, and B, is it your role as defender, would it be your role to continue to monitor this along with, I'm certain, the Disability Law Center to ensure that the law is enacted as intended?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, the work draft does address some of the concerns that we had noted with the initial version of the bill. The primary thing that the work draft does do is it provides people counsel, you know, as soon as they're being detained, which, the earlier version, it wasn't as clear as to when that would occur. So under the bill as it's written right now, the public defender agency would be appointed to every person that is being detained at a crisis residential center, just as we're appointed to everybody who's being held for evaluation under the current law for a 72-hour evaluation. So that would enable us to the extent we can. It is difficult, just in nature of these cases and the volume of them. It makes it difficult for our agency to stay on top of everybody who is being held on these, but having the agency appointed is a step in the right direction, and that was one of the concerns that we had noted with the first draft, and I think the work draft adopted by the committee at the last hearing does address that concern and would allow us to continue to have the opportunity to try and address problems that might occur with implementation.
Thank you, Madam Defender. That's an implication of a finance consideration, Mr. Chairman, who coincidentally also sits on the Finance Committee.
And I also want to clarify for the record, we're talking about the work draft version B that was adopted at that last time. At this time, I'm going to call up Ms. Nancy Mead so she could talk a little bit about, and I know this is not the Judiciary Committee, so I'm sorry for calling you up, Ms. Mead, just to give a quick overview of sort of the court's involvement in the process for Title 47 currently and how this bill may or may not change that process.
Thank you to the chair. This is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I'd be happy to answer questions to the extent I can. To answer the chair's question, currently under Title 4730, the court is involved when there is a involuntary admission for treatment. As Ms. Carpenter explained, those who are held or detained involuntarily at the initial stages are currently limited to certain facilities in the state, and unfortunately some of those end up in a jail, which is not optimal for those people, and I think everyone would agree with that. So what this bill does is create this subacute level, something less than the hospitals that we currently have available. When somebody currently, under current law 4730, is first taken to one of those places, a petition is filed with the court. The court holds an ex parte hearing and then sets and makes certain findings that the person is, as Senator Reinbold read earlier, the existing law, that the person is gravely disabled or suffering from a mental illness and likely to cause serious harm to self or others. If the person cannot safely, or if the person involved determines that it's not safe to do the sort of slower route of filing a petition and having the court order an assessment and then determining within 48 hours of the completion of the assessment when the person should be held, then the proceedings occur under 705, which is reproduced in your bill on Section 11, and that has the standard that I just read. The court then has a hearing, holds an ex parte hearing right away, and at that hearing sets a placeholder hearing. They can authorize that hold for 72 hours, and then within the 72 hours, they set a time, say Monday they have the hearing, they set a time for Wednesday afternoon for subsequent hearing if the professional people at the place where the person is held determine that the person needs to be held longer. The current law allows that second hearing to be for a 30-day mental commitment. This law then allows the person to be taken to this subacute facility, the Crisis Stabilization Center and a Crisis Residential Center. The court, again, has a hearing immediately, an ex parte hearing. If the court grants that, they notify everybody, including the public defender, a guardian, all the attorneys, that they know what's going on right away, and again, sets a placeholder time frame for the professional person in charge to either seek a mental commitment if they think that that's the appropriate setting for that individual, or to seek merely a lower level, a subacute level of a 7-day hold at a crisis residential center because they believe the person's mental health problems can be resolved within that 7-day period. Thereafter, other proceedings can take place, perhaps during the 7-day hold. If the court orders it, the person determines that, no, they really do need a 30-day commitment to a hospital. That petition can be filed and dealt with. But in any event, the court is involved at that initial ex parte stage, notifies everybody of their order, and sets a time period for a potential next hearing within 72 hours.
All right. Thank you for that very detailed explanation, Ms. Mead, or Counselor Mead, I keep. Senator Reinbold.
First of all, thank you for being here, and I do appreciate that description. I don't think anyone wants them in emergency rooms and jails. I mean, that we all are on board with that. So where my concerns are, and this may or may not be something you want to address, is if they don't have informed consent, something happens to the patient with the psychotropic, there's an episode. I don't know if you want to go down that path, but that's question number one. Who's responsible and what kind of patient rights? Because what I want to know in these new facilities, if you go into article, it's in the statutes. This is under 4730795 is where you guys are addressing quite a bit. If you go a little bit down further in article 10, patients' rights, I just want to make sure that in these new subacute facilities, these rights apply. And that's why I really care about what the public defender says about this bill. I really care about the psychiatrists and the psychologists, the recovered patients, the Jim Gottsteins, the Katz, the Faith Myers of the world. Those are the people that we've been working with for 2 years on this bill. And so those are the people that I care what they think about this bill. So I just want to make sure that in these new subacute facilities, or if any new facilities are being established, does Article 10, the patient's right, do they still apply?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, my reading of the bill is they do indeed, and I'm looking at page 7 of the of version B, which speaks to the rights of respondents at the crisis stabilization centers and crisis residential centers. And it says at the very bottom of the page that when they're held, the respondent has the rights identified in 725, and it goes on to say which ones apply specifically to the rights already delineated in the statutes for adults, and then at the top of page 8, those rights that are delineated for minors. So that clarifies that question for me.
Through the chair, can I?
Yes, and if Ms. Mead would like to defer, we also have a C. Bookman, the senior assistant attorney for the Department of Law, on hand if she feels those are out of her realm of representing the Alaska court system as well. Senator Reinbold.
And through the chair, that's extremely helpful. So thank you very, very much, because this is something that I've been trying to chase down, because there's in 47, 38, 39, this is the court-ordered administration of medication. So this whole area with this Article 10 and patient rights, to me, is of critical importance, and I want absolute definitiveness on the record that these patient rights from 4738.17 all the way through, you know, to the end of the chapter, do apply to these new facilities. And it sounds like to me the answer is yes.
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, my read of page 7, starting on line 21 through page 8, line 15, is that those rights and procedures set out in Title 10 or Article 10, the existing law and mental health do apply for these facilities as well with respect to patient rights and the involuntary administration of drugs.
Senator Ramble?
I just want to say thank you. That was one of my 10 biggest concerns. So thank you very, very much. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Ms. Mead, for coming up and giving us those wonderful detailed answers. Any other questions for the bill? Senator Hughes.
And actually, probably for Ms. Mead, too. I just want to understand better about, I know that when a hearing is scheduled, that parents and guardians of minors, and the question is, are guardians of non-minors also notified of hearings? And then are they also notified of the outcomes of those hearings if they don't show up and hear the outcome themselves?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes. The answer is the respondents' guardians are notified, and that is found on page 6 of the bill, line 2, as well as page 6, line 19, which says that the well, the top of it says the court shall notify the respondent's guardian, and we have that information and are willing to take that on. And the copy of the petition is provided. With respect to the order, those are always provided. Once the respondent's guardian is notified of the hearing, they become on the distribution list, and they thereafter receive every important, well, every court order in the case as a matter of routine and practice and probably rule, but I wouldn't be able to put my finger on that one. And it's also provided for on page 9, line 27, which adds the requirement that the court, if this bill passes, must notify the respondent's guardian for the currently existing procedure of mental commitments, which the court was doing during working hours but would find difficult to do during post-work hours, where a lot of these mental commitments unfortunately take place. But this bill will require us to do that for every single case, and we can do that.
And, yeah, Senator Wright, and just as clarification, kind of in layman's terms, so parents and guardians of minors, guardians of non-minors, are notified when there's a hearing. Then they get on a list, and so they're notified of the outcome or the orders given. So they would know, for instance, at the hearing that has to take place in 72 hours, they would be notified then that the patient is either going to be released or going to a 7-day residential center or be going to a longer-term 30-day center. They would be notified of all that, and that's happening now and will happen for these locations as well. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, that's generally happening now for mental commitments to the extent we are able to do it in a timely manner. This bill will require it even more so for mental commitments. In addition, this bill does require it for all of the hearings and holds that will take place for these subacute facilities, the Crisis Stabilization and Crisis Residential Center. So the rights of those parents and guardians are enhanced under this bill in both of the scenarios.
Okay, and then I have one other question that might reach outside Ms. Mead, but I did talk to Heather beforehand, and we're still trying to figure it out, and that's, I'm thinking of a scenario that could happen. Minors these days often spend a lot of hours away from their parents or guardians, so if an episode were to occur, law enforcement's called, and a minor is taken to a stabilization center, is there anything right now where law enforcement is required, the courts would be required to notify the parents and the parents or guardian that the child has been taken to a stabilization center, or do we need to fix that in this bill?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, that may not be a question for the court system. We wouldn't find out about somebody taken to a stabilization center, which is the 24-hour place, until a petition is filed with the court. So perhaps that would be better addressed to the CSC personnel or experts.
Mr. Chair, could we ask the Department of Public Safety if they're picking up a child, say that incident happens at a school and they're going to take the child to a stabilization center, are they required already to notify the parents?
Yeah, we can definitely put that request into the department, but they are not online. They're here today. They're tied up another.
Well, we have Kelly Howe here.
No, she's.
Oh. She was able to make it. Oh, okay. Okay.
It's Kelly Good.
Okay. Well, I guess that's an outstanding question then that I would like to know, because I believe that parents should be notified within a very reasonable short amount of time.
Unless one of our other folks may, I don't think Ms. Brown may.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that may be the best question for Stephen Bookman.
All right. Stephen Bookman, did you hear the question from Senator Hughes?
Yes, Chair, I did. And through the chair, Senator, currently in this draft we have that all notices that are required to be served on the respondent when the respondent is a minor shall also be served on the parent or guardian of a respondent who is a minor. And so currently the court system has a form that is used when there is an emergency hold taken under the 705 statute, and that statute is that that form is given to the person who's being held. Ms. Mead may be able to talk about that. And it says, you know, you're being detained while we evaluate, you know, while a professional evaluates you. And to the extent that that sort of form would be given to the minor, if the minor is being taken to a crisis stabilization center, then this bill would require that same notice, that same form, to be sent to the minor's parents or guardian. I do note that there may be logistical problems with finding out the address or how to contact the parent or guardian.
And follow up?
Yes, follow up.
So there's no time frame. So, you know, if my child were, or grandchild were going to be picked up, well, I guess I'm, as a grandchild, I'm not the guardian, but let's say I were, I would like to know as soon as possible. So there's no time factor, and I am just thinking that there should be, Mr. Chair. So I don't know if this is the court. Ms. Mead didn't think it was something that would fall in the court, but it sounds like maybe it does. So could she speak to that? And I thought the first notification was the hearing notification, but now we're hearing that there's an earlier notification.
No, so I think there's two different questions that are being commingled here. And I think Mr. Bookman, I think Senator Hughes, your question was upon if once they get picked up by a peace officer, how's that notification given? And my understanding that that works pretty fast. I used to manage a 24-hour hold facility for juvenile youth while the police officers would try to find those individuals and parents and guardians, and sometimes that could be a lengthy process, and sometimes it's not. There is paperwork that they can hold without 24 hours, without sort of charging or giving those additional paperwork or fill out that paperwork, and that's why those facilities existed under current statute. But I, you know, putting a time limit on how soon that they could try to find a parent or guardian, and you know, if the youth is not able to do so and not able to coherently give exact information until they come down from that crisis center or if they're incapacitated, that might be a harder task to do. And I know that our public safety folks try really hard to do that, but that's a difficult, but we will try to get that information from public safety in terms of that question. I think that was sort of commingled into the question that Ms. Mead sort of answered upon the notifications after they hit that court system piece of the when that clock starts.
Okay, thank you. And I do think it's worth it. And I know that you can't always find a person, but it seems like it would be reasonable that attempts to reach, notify the parents should begin, you know, right away or within a very short time. And whether they're successful, we can't guarantee that, but I would like to see some kind of guarantee that would happen. Then I would also extend it to, you know, someone moves from age 17, 18 to age 19, 20, and you can have in some of these folks that struggle with mental illness, they could be in their 30s, 40s, and 50s and could be in a place where their guardian also needs to be notified that they are being taken to a stabilization center. And we know through Ms. Mead's testimony that guardian of that adult would be notified of the hearing, but that could be 72 hours later. So is there anything where a non-minor who has a guardian, is that guardian notified that they're taken to the stabilization center?
And technically, and I misspoke, I'm sorry, it was a 16-hour hold room that was in statute before. And I'm not sure if Mr. Bookman wants to answer that, but I believe that once they start that court petition of doing a voluntary hold, that the courts will have to notify. So once they are taken and they begin that involuntary commitment, then they will be notified. But that's my interpretation. I'll let Ms. Mead or Mr. Bookman answer that.
Through the chair, I'll give it a shot. As soon as a court grants the ex parte application, and that happens within 24 hours because the ex parte hearing happens within 24 hours. The grant is a piece of paper saying granted or not, but if it's granted, it's granted, and further proceedings are set for a couple of days later. That piece of paper goes to the guardian and the parent if we can locate them, and every effort is made, just like with every arrest, to notify the parent and locate them. So it's actually within that very short time period that guardians and parents will have notice, if not sooner, at a crisis stabilization center. If they're able to identify other, you know, parents and guardians, they can do their best. But at the very least, if and when the court grants the ex parte, which is within 24 hours, they'll make sure that the parents or guardian and guardian are served.
And follow up?
Yes, follow up.
So I suppose that's just a policy call we as members could consider, because it sounds like it could be as long as 24 hours before the court would reach out. So the question is, should there be some requirement for either law enforcement or the staff at the stabilization center to make an attempt to notify parents and guardians? I am thinking that if it were up to me, I would want that requirement. So that's just something we as members should consider, whether we're comfortable in as long as a 24-hour delay, and because the court will be doing that, or whether there should be something prior and pretty much within the first few hours of the person being at the stabilization center. Thank you.
And that might be, yeah, we can try to get answers to that. Senator Reinbold.
So thank you. I do think that's a really important issue, the notice versus informed consent, because you can notify a patient something, and this issue goes back to parental rights. So I do think that issue definitely needs to be fleshed out. I've gotten several emails in regards to that. I also got an email from Faith Myers, and she said one of her main concerns is that disabled psychiatric patients receive fair rights, and that's why I'm so thankful for your comment, actually. It's estimated that about 10,000 people annually are transported or made to undergo forced evaluation and some type of forced treatment. She states that Alaska is about 30 years behind best practices in passing laws that protect disabled psychiatric patients. So just want you guys to know that that's an angle that I really want to work on, is protecting the patient rights. And that's why, with your indulgence, I just want to make sure that people understand that in Article 10, this is that their advanced health care directives are honored, that their patient medical rights are honored, that prohibition of experimental treatments like the COVID-19 vaccine, are prohibited. The nutritional evaluations are honored, and they have a right to a proper diet, because so many mental health issues can be corrected with proper diet. So civil rights are not impaired. Psychotropic medications in non-crisis situations, it addresses that in Section 836. Informed consent is in 837. Psychotropic medications in crisis situations, it addresses 838 and 839. The court-ordered administration of medications. And in regards to that, I don't believe anybody here wants to answer if there is a side effect from those. I believe that would be a psychiatrist that we would need to answer, because if a patient, if my son or daughter, whatever, would get administered a drug and then there was a side effect, who is responsible? I mean, what is their grievances? And that's why I think it's so important in Section 840, the right to privacy and personal possessions and other rights, confidential records, patients' grievances procedures is of critical importance, sealing records, relief from legal disability, posting of rights, documents and notices in other languages, and discrimination prohibited. So that's kind of, it's just a huge issue to me. And so I want to make sure that everybody understands where I'm coming from, and that's why I wanted to get that in the official record, and it sounds like these rights are protected in this bill. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman?
That was my understanding, hearing from General Counsel of the court system and Mr. Bookman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, could I add one fact to the record that the committee may find relevant with respect to the mental commitment petitions that the court sees? So right now, if somebody is having a mental health crisis or is believed to be gravely disabled, the only thing that's available is these involuntary mental commitments under Title 4730. And just for some perspective, last year there were 1,880 72-hour petitions received. That is the involuntary initial hospitalization. So those are the immediate three-day holds. And of those, 235, well, not of those, there were also 235 30-day ones committed. So what that tells you is out of about 1,900 people who were admitted for 3 days. Most of those did not result in further proceedings. Only 235 resulted in further proceedings. So that's our total number of those filed in 2020. That's down. That was a pandemic year. So if I go back a couple of years, the highest I could find were about 2,500 petitions filed for the three-day, and of those, 167 led to further holdings. So you could conclude from that, although I don't necessarily want to draw conclusions, is that most people resolve within that initial hospitalization or further proceedings are deemed not appropriate for that individual, if that's helpful.
It's not like there's a higher percentage during the pandemic, if I do my math correctly.
Percentage-wise. And no.
All right. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Okay. Seeing none, our next, thank you, everyone that was online and able to attend. Our next meeting will be this Thursday, St. Patty's Day. We'll set this bill up and bring it back on Thursday. Amendments are due to my office by tomorrow, March 16th at 5 p.m. We'll take this bill up again on Thursday, along with SB 175, healthcare costs by telehealth, and consider amendments. That concludes our... Yes, Senator Baggins.
So just to clarify, amendments are due tomorrow, but you, your staff, and the department, I mean, that was said earlier, but your staff and department are working on some of those that came from Mr. Gottstein's letter. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So I just want to be sure I don't miss a deadline because your office is handling those. That's correct,
yes,
right?
We will distribute those out as soon as we get them drafted to make sure that they meet that standard, and we'll... I would urge you as well to.
Well, you don't want me to ask legal, I think, to draft amendments as well, because that would overburden our legal department. Right. We've been instructed
not
to.
And so we will make sure that we work with your office to make sure that that accommodates that, as you made on the record.
I trust your trustworthy staff and you, so I will look forward to seeing them.
Yes, we will work with you before we lay that out to make sure that that meets the definition of what was discussed in committee on the 8th.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Again, that concludes. Any closing comments from members?
Yes, I do.
Senator Hughes.
It was something earlier, and I'm not going to pull it back up, but it was really helpful. It was mentioned, then I looked it up too, in the statute, that if an officer sees someone and is going to take them to a stabilization center, that it cannot, it must include the element of that they're in imminent danger of hurting themselves or someone else. It cannot just be a mental condition or an episode. It has to involve that danger piece. And that was really helpful to me. And I do really like the fact that that person is not going to if we were to pass it, that person would be taken to a less restrictive place, not to a hospital and not to a jail. So, but that danger element must be present. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. You know, with further comments, we are adjourned at 2:45 p.m.